All right, we're going to Genesis chapter 18. We are continuing our series through Genesis this morning. This is message number 19 in the series entitled Questions and Answers. We'll be looking at the whole chapter. We're going to start here reading verses 1 and 2. And the Lord appeared unto him in the plains of Mamre, and he sat in the tent door in the heat of the day, and lift up his eyes and looked, and lo, three men stood by him. And when he saw them, he ran to meet them from the tent door and bowed himself toward the ground. Now, Abraham and Sarah had settled into normal life and had lived for 13 years with Ishmael being the supposed heir and promised seed of the covenant. But chapter 17 breaks into that happy little scene with the appearance of the Lord and the announcement that Sarah herself would have a son who was the true promised seed. Now, the physical abilities of Abraham and Sarah to have children had now moved into the realm of the impossible. And so Abraham tries to make sense of this pronouncement. And by this point, all the natural and physical explanations are ruled out, and Sarah having a child can only be a miracle of divine intervention. Now, in the bigger picture, God had promised to make Abraham a nation and to give him the land of Canaan in perpetuity through his physical descendants. That was the people of Israel. And Sarah's continued barrenness had continued to pass the point of natural childbearing, and that poses a seemingly unresolvable difficulty to God's word being true. And this sets us readers up as we go into chapter number 18. Chapter 18 recounts this extraordinary visit to Abraham, and it bridges between the promises of this promised seed and then the destruction of Sodom to come. So this chapter 18, that is, revolves around two primary questions. The first being, is anything too hard for the Lord? That comes in verse number 14. And then the second question is, shall the judge of all the earth do right? In verse number 25. So the faithfulness of God is put up against the backdrop of human impossibility, or the impossibility of nature, you might even say. When all human experience and understanding recognizes impossibility, is God hindered or prevented from keeping His word? He's made a promise that now seems impossible to fulfill, so is God limited or restrained? And then the second question has to do with the justice of God. And the justice of God is being actually established in the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah. And we see something of a formal proceeding as this judgment of Sodom is discussed toward the latter part of this chapter. So chapter 18 brought Sarah more clearly into the covenant and the covenant discussion. And chapter 18 tests her faith just as it has tested Abraham's. So we'll look at this chapter in two different parts, verses 1 to 15, where we see God can do anything, and in verses 16 to 33, where we see that God will do the right thing. So let's look here, starting with the first part. We'll look at verses 1 to 8. And the Lord appeared unto him in the plains of Mamre, and he sat in the tent door in the heat of the day. And he lift up his eyes and looked, and lo, three men stood by him. And when he saw them, he ran to meet them from the tent door and bowed himself toward the ground and said, My Lord, if now I have found favor in thy sight, pass not away, I pray thee, from thy servant. Let a little water, I pray you, be fetched, and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree. And I will fetch a morsel of bread. And comfort ye your hearts, after that ye shall pass on, for therefore are ye come to your servant. And they said, So do as thou hast said. And Abraham hastened into the tent unto Sarah, and said, Make ready quickly three measures of fine meal, knead it, and make cakes upon the hearth. And Abraham ran unto the herd, and fetched a calf tender and good, and gave it unto a young man, and he hasted to dress it. And he took butter and milk and the calf which he had dressed and set it before them. And he stood by them under the tree, and they did eat. So we are told once again that the Lord appeared. Yahweh appeared to Abraham. And then we read that there were three men that stood by Abraham at the tent door. Now, as we go on reading, it becomes very clear that one of these is, in fact, Christ. One of these is a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ in a human form. And the other two are angels, what we would refer to as angels, these created spirit beings that dwell in heaven with God, that are His worshipers, that are His messengers, that are His servants that go and do His bidding throughout the universe. And the fact that they are described to us as three men means that they were in the appearance of human males, and not just in the appearance, but they even apparently eat a meal that Abraham has prepared for them. Now, Abraham's response to these visitors is what is emphasized in these first eight verses. He runs to meet them. He bows. He honors them as his guests. He provides hospitality for them by attending to the common and expected needs of travelers, a place to rest, a place to be refreshed, the washing of their feet, the preparing of food for their nourishment and their refreshment. And the description of the meal that we get here in these verses shows us that this was more than just the common fare, than probably what would typically have been eaten by Abraham and his household and his servants and such, at the time of midday as this was. And even the note that Abraham stood as they ate, that he stood by as they ate, showing a respect and a deference that is being paid to them. Now, as we read through the Bible, we oftentimes have questions that the text doesn't answer. And as a preacher for many years now, it's been my experience that those are usually the questions I get asked, the ones that there are not answers to. Those are the ones that usually people are most interested in. Now, sometimes we read and we have a question, and there's no answer in the text. Sometimes the answer's there. It just requires deeper and broader study than just on the surface. And there are other times that we have questions that are prompted by something that we have read that the Bible simply just doesn't tell us. Maybe there's something we'd like to know, but the Bible just doesn't tell us. And it can be easy to get caught up in what's not there and what the Bible doesn't tell us, but we always have to come back to the fact that what is there, what is given to us, is given for a reason. This is what God wants us to know. So for just an example, we read these first eight verses and we get this introduction of these three extraordinary visitors, but actually we're told very little about them. How did they get there? For instance, what exactly did they look like? How were they dressed? What type of accent did they speak with? Did Abraham think them to be foreigners in any way? Or would they have seemed to be foreigners to those in the land? And I mean, we can come up with all kinds of questions about these visitors that we're just not told about. And any guesses that we might make would really just be speculation and maybe even imagination. We really don't know. And rather than answering those sort of questions, when you read these first eight verses, we get a lot of detail about Abraham's actions. We get a lot of detail about the food that he fixed for him. We're told that it was a young calf that's tender and good, butter and milk and the calf that had been dressed that he takes to them to eat. Like, why are we given those kind of details? I mean, that seems rather boring, right? I mean, we're given ingredients of the meal that Abraham made for them, but we're not told what they looked like or how they got there or many other questions that we might ask about them. Well, maybe by the time that we get to the end of this chapter, we'll have some ideas from the text of why this is here the way it is and what is emphasized. So let's go on. We'll go to verses 9 to 15 now. And they said unto him, "Where is Sarah thy wife?" And he said, "Behold, in the tent." And he said, "I will certainly return unto thee according to the time of life, and lo, Sarah thy wife shall have a son." And Sarah heard it in the tent door, which was behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old and well stricken in age, and it ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. Therefore Sarah laughed within herself, saying, "I am waxed old. Shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also?" And the Lord said unto Abraham, "Wherefore did Sarah laugh, saying, 'Shall I of a surety bear a child which am old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the time appointed, I will return unto thee according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son.' Then Sarah denied, saying, 'I laughed not, for she was afraid.' And he said, 'Nay, but thou didst laugh.'" So now the account here turns to Sarah, and she was made more prominent in the previous chapters as it was made clear that the promise was to her as well as to Abraham, and that she, in fact, would be the mother of the promised seed that would come from Abraham's own body. And so Sarah hears this promise being repeated now, and again, this time frame that's been given that the Lord is going to return, and that she herself is going to have a son. Now, the text obviously gives us a note that she was past her ability to have children. It had ceased to be with her after the manner of women, which is sort of the language that is used here. We might simply say she was post-menopause. It just wasn't physically possible at her age and her condition for her to have children. And then we see her response, which very much mirrors the response that we had of Abraham previously when the Lord spoke to him. She laughs and she thought within herself that her and Abraham were just unable to have children. Like this is just not possible. This is physically impossible. It says that she says, "After I am waxed old." And when you look at the word in the original, it actually literally means worn out. I'm old and worn out, Sarah says. I can't possibly have any children. And so again, it's not a derisive type of laugh or a mocking type of laugh, but again, an expression of disbelief, much like it was with Abraham, that this is just not possible. This is not something that can happen now. It was a cherished hope for many years from when she first had it that Abraham was going to have a son, but now it has just become something that is impossible. Now, it might be easy for us to condemn Sarah here, but the Bible affirms that Sarah believed, that she was a woman of faith. In fact, the writer of Hebrews wrote in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 11 to 12, "Through faith also Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore sprang there even of one, and him as good as dead, so many as the stars of the sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore innumerable." So the writer of Hebrews helps us understand that through faith she received strength to conceive seed. So there was a miracle worked in her physically so that she was able to conceive and bear and deliver a child, and she did this by faith. So again, I don't really think the point here is for us to be overly harsh and critical towards Sarah, but she is just expressing the disbelief by the fact that this has become impossible. And of course, this whole situation sets us up. We see this stress being made. We've talked about those time markers that goes on, how Abraham and Sarah are getting older, and now we're seeing more and more of that piled up. And here we come to the fact that it's just simply past time for her to even be able to have a child. And we're all being set up for this statement in verse number 14. "Is there anything too hard for the Lord?" Well, the answer is obviously that no, there is nothing that is too hard for the Lord. To put this another way, there is nothing that is impossible for God. So this is the statement that she is given. This is again where her faith is directed. There's nothing impossible for the Lord. Don't disbelieve because our limitations, in another way of putting it, are not God's limitations. And then we go to the second part of the chapter, which transitions to Sodom and Gomorrah, where we learn in this part of the chapter that God will do the right thing. So let's start with verses 16 to 22. And the men rose up from thence and looked toward Sodom, and Abraham went with them to bring them on the way. And the Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him? For I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, that they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him." And the Lord said, "Because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grievous, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which has come unto me, and if not, I will know." And the men turned their faces from thence and went toward Sodom, but Abraham stood yet before the Lord. So this account now turns toward Sodom and Gomorrah in particular, which seems somewhat abrupt. But as you're reading here, this is a continuing of the narrative. The three visitors come to Abraham. We have all of this that takes place in the first part of the chapter, and they're still with him. But now they start moving toward Sodom. The two angels go on to Sodom, as we see in the next chapter. And the Lord, the pre-incarnate Christ, stays with Abraham to speak with him. So certainly one of the reasons for the visit was to go to Sodom, just as it was to speak to Abraham and to Sarah. Now, we get something here that's a bit unusual to encounter in the Bible, and we get this sort of internal dialogue. We get the Lord speaking with himself. He's thinking with himself. He's asking of himself, "Shall I hide from Abraham that thing that I'm going to do?" So this is a rare view that we are being given, but we do have to be careful that we understand the purpose of these verses and this internal conversation that we see. And I would say that it is very similar to what we see in Jesus' prayer when he is there by the tomb of Lazarus in John chapter number 11, particularly when he says this in verses 41 and 42. "Then they took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said," he spoke out loud, "Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me, and I knew that thou hearest me always, but because of the people which stand by, I said it, that they may believe that thou hast sent me." In other words, Jesus was not unsure of being heard. He prays to the Father, and he's not uncertain as to whether or not this prayer is going to be answered. But he says that he makes this statement to serve the purpose of revelation and faith, that they standing by might know. In other words, it's for our good. It is for our benefit, and it is revealing something to us. So here we have a similar situation. We have the pre-incarnate Jesus who is having this conversation, it would seem, or this internal dialogue, or this internal thought, much like Sarah had just a little while earlier. Now, the point is that he is not unsure of what he's going to do. He came to do something. He's not unsure of what he's going to do. But what this internal dialogue does is it brings God's covenant with Abraham again to the foreground. You see, God had promised to bless Abraham and through Abraham to bless all the nations of the earth. Furthermore, he had also promised that there would be blessing and cursing to the nations of the earth according to how they blessed or cursed Abraham and his nation, the nation of Israel. So God has revealed that he is going to work in the world with the nations of the world through Abraham. And that certainly is the point. That provides us with a sufficient reason for God to interact with him on this judgment of some nations, particularly here of Sodom and Gomorrah. So in other words, we're seeing some fulfillment already of God's promises to Abraham that he's going to bless and or curse these nations of the earth through him or in relation to him. So that sets us up then for God to bring Abraham into this discussion of what he's going to do. And then we get to verses 23 to 33. And Abraham drew near and said, "Wilt thou also destroy the righteous with the wicked? Peradventure there be 50 righteous within the city. Wilt thou also destroy and not spare the place for 50 righteous that are therein? That be far from thee to do after this manner, to slay the righteous with the wicked, and that the righteous should be as the wicked. That be far from thee. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right?" And the Lord said, "If I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare all the place for their sakes." And Abraham answered and said, "Behold now, I've taken upon me to speak unto the Lord, which am but dust and ashes. Peradventure there shall lack 5 of the 50 righteous. Wilt thou destroy all the city for lack of 5? And he said, "If I find there 40 and 5, I will not destroy it." And he spake unto him yet again and said, "Peradventure there shall be 40 found there." And he said, "I will not do it for 40's sake." And he said unto him, "Oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak. Peradventure there shall 30 be found there." And he said, "I will not do it if I find 30 there." And he said, "Behold now, I have taken upon me to speak unto the Lord. Peradventure there shall be 20 found there." And he said, "I will not destroy it for 20's sake." And he said, "Oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak yet but this once. Peradventure 10 shall be found there." And he said, "I will not destroy it for 10's sake." And the Lord went his way as soon as he had left communing with Abraham, and Abraham returned unto his place. So the last part of this chapter contains this dialogue between Abraham and the pre-incarnate Christ as they are speaking over Sodom and Gomorrah in particular. And there's, again, we get sort of an official procession, almost a ceremonial feel as we go through what seems like a negotiation between Abraham and Christ. Now, so the question then counts down from 50 righteous in the city all the way down to 10. You know, are you going to destroy this whole city if there be 50 righteous? And that could be a pretty significant number. When we think of city, we tend to think of a very large population. This may have had a population in the hundreds. We don't know how much that it could have been there. So 50 could have been maybe a more significant number than what it seems. But nevertheless, this countdown from 50 gets all the way down to 10. If there could even be 10 righteous that are found there, will you destroy this whole city? Now the key question obviously comes in verse number 25. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? So this is what is at stake in what we're reading here, this discussion between Christ and Abraham. And that is, will the Lord act justly in the judgment of Sodom? So the judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah, what we learn as we continue reading throughout the Bible, is that this judgment that comes on Sodom and Gomorrah actually forms a pattern or a template for judgment, especially future judgment, to come. So we get this judgment referred to at the end of the Pentateuch in Deuteronomy chapter 29, verse 22, and chapter 32 and verse 32. We get several references back to Sodom and Gomorrah in the writings of the prophets much later, like Isaiah and Jeremiah and Amos and Zephaniah and Jeremiah again in the book of Lamentations. We also get references to the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah again as a pattern or a type of future judgment in the New Testament. We have it in Matthew, in Luke, in Romans, in 2 Peter, in the book of Jude, and in Revelation. So this judgment that's about to take place hasn't taken place at this point, as we read in Genesis chapter 18. But this judgment that is about to take place is teaching us about God's judgment in general and His future judgments more in particular. We're learning something about God's judgment in what He's doing here at Sodom and Gomorrah. And so we have this sort of a official feeling a process that is gone through as Christ and Abraham discuss this judgment. And so when we think about this judgment forming something of a pattern for judgment that is to come later, then we can see that certain things are being established. Because the opening question was, in verse 23, "Wilt thou also destroy the righteous with the wicked?" So when God brings judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah, and this is a pattern of future, is He just going to destroy everything and everyone? Is there just going to be an indiscriminate judgment that's just going to rain down the wrath of God on the righteous as well as the wicked? Well, what we see then is through this process is that the justice of God's judgment is being established. Notice that, first of all, the Lord comes to see. He says that He has heard of the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah, of the great wickedness that of those cities. He's heard of it, and He comes to see. So in other words, He is investigating, which these will become principles that become much more apparent in the Mosaic Law later. He has heard, but He's not going to judge Sodom and Gomorrah based on hearsay. Now, again, this isn't taking away from the omniscience of God, that God is all-knowing. God knows what's going on. He knows what's in the hearts of the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. He knows what actions that they are taking. But again, there's almost a formality of the process that is revealing that God's judgment is always just. The judge of all the earth does right. So God's not going to judge them based on hearsay. God, He comes to see. The pre-incarnate Christ comes to see the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. Not only does He do that, but He establishes the guilt of these cities by sending two witnesses to confirm what is going on in the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah in the persons of these angels. And furthermore, He says, "I will not destroy the city if there are 50, if there are 45, if there are 40, if there are 30, if there are 20, if there are 10. And then what if there are less than 10? We get that answer when we come to the next chapter. So He shows that He's going to judge the wicked, but He's going to deliver the righteous so that they do not endure His wrath. Again, we're getting a template or a pattern of God's judgment. We're being taught something about God's judgment going through this whole process with Abraham. He's going to deal with the nations of the world through Abraham, and He's going to discriminate between the righteous and the wicked in His judgment. So in the end, the judge of all the earth does right. He judges with just judgment. He will reward the righteous and the guilty accordingly. So now as we think about chapter number 18, as we continue reading our way through the book of Genesis, one way of reading this account would be to come to a verse like verse 14 and to try to appropriate it. All right, so this would be along the line of saying, well, If anything is possible with God, then anything that I can dream up, as long as I have enough faith, then God will do it. Well, that would be a way of trying to appropriate what's being said here. That actually would be a misreading of the text. Because what is the context of that statement? Is anything too hard for God? And that statement gets echoed later in a couple of the prophets' writings. But what is the context? Well, first of all, remember, This is being written to that generation of Israel that is about to go in and to take the promised land according to the direction and the promise of God. Is anything too hard for God? Well, the context is that God has given revelation to Abraham and to Sarah. He's given them revelation in the form of a promise. You are going to have a son. Abraham and Sarah are going to have a son next year at about this time. So he has given a promise. He's given a revelation to them. This is God's purpose that he has revealed to them, that they're going to have a son in their old age. And the fulfillment of that promise by this point has now moved into the realm of physical impossibility. In purely human and natural terms, this is impossible. This cannot happen. So the point of the statement is that nothing prevents God from doing everything he has purposed to do. Doesn't matter how impossible that it may seem. Nothing is impossible with God in terms of him fulfilling all of his purpose. So, on the one hand, it is true that God can do anything, so to speak, but it's also true that he only will do what he has purposed to do to completely fulfill his word and his will. Well, this is why the Bible teaches us such things as praying if the Lord wills. Because he can and will do everything that he has purposed to do. So the proper application for us today of a verse like verse number 14 is to believe and to trust God to do everything he has revealed that he will do. We pray about our own difficult circumstances. We pray about the difficult situations of others. We ask God, if it is according to his will, to remove that difficulty. But here's the answer. And see, sometimes we ask questions that, and we don't like the answer. And we don't want the answer. But here is the answer. God either will or he won't. He will either remove that difficulty or he won't. But either way, he's only going to do it according to his own purpose. And what we must understand is that we have to know and to trust that his purpose-directed actions are always right and good. We may not understand them. They may not necessarily line up with what we want in that moment, but they are always right and good. And that brings us to the second major issue in the text, and that's God's justice. God always does right, especially in his judgments. God always does right. He properly discerns between the righteous and the wicked in judgment. But why did we have so much description of Abraham's hospitality? Let's come back to the calf and the butter and the milk. When we've got a lot of other questions that we might like answered, and yet we're getting all of this about Abraham's hospitality. Well, Abraham's reception of the visitors obviously contrasts with what the angels received in the city of Sodom when they go there in the next chapter. But again, this is a continual account. And so Abraham's actions in the beginning of this chapter are in some way linked with the judgment on Sodom after that the Lord expressly brings Abraham into his assessment of the judgment on Sodom. Well, the judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah is a foreshadowing of that eschatological, that end time judgment on the nations when Jesus returns at the end of the tribulation period. Matthew chapter 25 tells us how the nations of the earth will be gathered before the Son of Man on that day and how they will be judged. They will be judged or blessed based on how they blessed or cursed Abraham. Matthew chapter 25 verses 34 to 36. Then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, Come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was an hungered, and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. These were the actions of Abraham. And these also will be the actions of those who have the faith of Abraham. On the other hand, in verses 41 to 43, Then shall he say also unto them on the left hand, Depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was an hungered, and ye gave me no meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me not in. Naked, and ye clothed me not. Sick, and in prison, and ye visited me not. Those were the actions of the men of Sodom when the angels of the Lord came to visit them. Well, these judgments are then explained, this future judgment in Matthew 25. Matthew 25, verse 40, "And the king shall answer and say unto them," that was those that inherit everlasting life, "Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me." To the group that departs into everlasting fire, in verse 45, "Then shall he answer them, saying, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye did it not to one of the least of these, you did it not to me." Well, the least of these, his brethren, these are the children of Abraham, the sons of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or what we know as the Jewish people of Israel. So this leaves us then with the assurance that God will judge between the righteous and the wicked. Abraham was made righteous through faith, showing us the way to escape the judgment that comes surely on the wicked. And that is through faith in Jesus Christ.